Welcome to Season 11, Episode 29 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It is Tuesday, the 25th of September, and we're going to discuss what's been happening in the news and community. I'm Martin, and I will be driving the show this evening with efficiency and timekeeping like has never been seen before on the Ubuntu Podcast. And joining me this week are Mark.
Hello.
Hello. And Alan.
Hello.
Brilliant. Okay, we'll ignore Alan being late to the show, Mark. Mark, what have you been up to?
I have been networking.
So, is this rewiring the house networking or meeting people networking?
The first one.
Rewiring the house networking?
Yes, or wiring it in the first place, in fact.
Ah, new house, new networking. So, what have you been up to?
I have been running cables through the loft, and then I was going to run some cables downstairs as well, but I ran out of cable.
Wow, this is serious networking.
Yes, I now have gigabit Ethernet to every bedroom and to one side of my lounge, but not to the other side yet. And eventually I'll have it to the garage too.
How do you terminate these things? Are they like just dangling from the ceiling and you have to like plug them
no,
in?
No, I've like got like
jack
proper
in
sockets
the back of
and
your
everything.
Neck or something. Or
it's not like the days of BNC and AUI where you have to terminate these network cables.
Yeah, and twist a spike into the cable.
Although, Mark, it is 2018. Why are you running cables around the house? Have you not heard of Wi-Fi?
Yeah, Wi-Fi is for chumps.
Hey, Martin. How's it being a chump?
Well, I've got a wired solution, but I've done power over Ethernet. So you've obviously done actual, like, OG Ethernet cables.
I think maybe you mean Ethernet over power.
Whichever.
Yeah.
I don't have enough sockets for Ethernet over power to be an option, unfortunately.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I would have no power if you did Ethernet over power.
Did you know you can get pass-through Ethernet over power ones that you can plug other things into?
Did you know that I've just finished networking my house? I don't need this information.
I'm sorry.
And also, what if I want to plug in a guitar amp?
Yes.
Hey?
Yes.
Explain.
My son's guitar amp buzzes when there is Ethernet over power going on in the house, which is all the time.
That is some epic callback, Mark. Well played. So how is your gigabit network in all of the rooms? Is it all up and running?
Yeah, I like tested all the cables and everything worked pretty much first time. I had a small issue joining two Ethernet cables together with a slightly cheaper than I should have bought coupling block. But no, everything's tickety-boo, as Alan might say.
So the question on every listener's lips right now is, do you have gigabit Ethernet to the renovated bathroom?
I do not.
Oh, this is disappointing because we know bathroom chat trends really well on the Ubuntu podcast.
No.
It is disappointing. There is not a tie-in to bathroom chat.
No, unfortunately, I wasn't confident in running cabling through the bathroom because I know that there are certain regulations that should be met, and I expect I would have breached them and possibly electrocuted myself in the process.
Right, okay. All the listeners have lost interest now. So, Alan, we're going to rescue the situation with what have you been up to?
I've been renovating my bathroom. No, I
this
haven't.
Is brilliant.
I haven't at all. Oh. I've been playing with virtual machines, lots and lots and lots of virtual machines. But we should probably talk in more depth about this at another time because I could talk for a long time about this.
Oh, this sounds exciting.
Are you suggesting this is a segment for a later episode of the Ubuntu podcast?
I don't know. Ask me next week.
All right, I'll ask. Well, Mark can ask you next week. So, moving on. And now it is time for some news. Alan, did you find any news this week?
There is only one piece of news the whole week that every single Linux podcaster and every Linux and tech news site has picked up on, and that is that we're currently on a break. And Linus Torvalds is having a bit of time off to do a bit of soul searching and understand himself better and maybe become a bit more empathetic to other people.
Or quite possibly write an email filter which doesn't let him send swear emails.
Or both. Yeah, maybe there's going to be a new project that comes out of this, because after other conflicts that have happened in the Linux community, when, you know, many years ago there was conflict in which revision control system to use. Linus created Git. Maybe he will create some other new project to fix this. But in the meantime, human beings have created a code of conduct for the Linux community. And this has gone down really well or really badly, depending upon who you ask. In general, it seems a good thing to try and moderate the behavior of people who work together, who happen to be in different places and have different perspectives on what is good behavior.
But Alan, we shouldn't need to be told what to do to write good software because everyone's perfect.
Well, it turns out that's not the case. And actually,
citation R Linux.
Some of the things some of these people have said over the years probably would have got them fired from jobs. But because these aren't jobs and these are people who are doing stuff in their spare time or the stuff they're contributing to, they're not being directly paid for and Linus isn't their line manager, that didn't happen. But still, we are where we are. And there's been quite a brouhaha about this. I don't think we need to go into it in tremendous detail because everyone else has covered this in tremendous depth. I come from the perspective of working on a Linux distro where there has been a code of conduct ever since I started working on it and years before. So I've been around codes of conduct for a while, and I generally think they're a good thing personally.
Yes. And this particular code of conduct is used by numerous open source projects, which don't appear to have become some sort of PC dystopia.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, this is a code of conduct for the Linux kernel community, not the Linux community, those people that are actively engaging in the development of the Linux kernel. And it is for them to decide the code of conduct that best suits them, their work practices, and their community. If you are outside of that community and you're not looking to join it and you're not looking to pursue a career as a kernel maintainer, then having comment and opinion about this really isn't helpful, because unless you're part of that group of people that's working together on a regular basis, then it's for them to decide the best way to govern their project. And this isn't about political correctness. This is about project governance. Mark, what other news have you found this week?
Well, in other good news, Twitter might have leaked direct messages.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
What are direct messages?
So these are the messages which you send on Twitter that are between you and another person and aren't published publicly. But I mean, I've always assumed that Twitter can and do read or scan these in some sort of way.
Yeah.
But it turns out that a bug in their API might have resulted in messages being sent to the wrong people or being made available to the wrong people via the API. It sounds like they're to do with companies who are using Twitter for support. So I don't know if there's some sort of special account or API access that companies can get from Twitter if they're running a support channel through Twitter.
I think there is, because a lot of these places have it integrated into their support systems and they can tie your Twitter account into whatever your customer account is in their internal systems. So they can, when Popey rants about how rubbish Virgin Media are and they DM you and say, hey, we're fixing the cable in your area, they know exactly who that is.
Surely you would never say such a thing.
No, not this week anyway.
Alan only rants about the memory usage of Slack on Twitter.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, a lot of us got little pop-up messages in the Twitter client to tell us that this had happened. I got one this week. And, it's a bit sad, but I guess developers make mistakes. Hey-ho.
Surely not. Surely such a thing would never happen, right,
guys?
Well,
it wouldn't happen if it was all encrypted, like end-to-end and encrypted at the other end and stored. Well, it still could, actually, even if it was encrypted, like someone had an API access that unencrypted it and showed it to them, I guess it could. But
are you suggesting that other encrypted person-to-person messaging services are available?
They are, and actually I've started using other ones. I tend to privately message people on Wire or Signal these days, both of which are available as Snaps on the desktop and also available on mobile as well.
Well played. Cha-ching. So, in news of other developers making mistakes, Google Chrome 69 signs into the browser automatically now. So what this means is that every time you log into a Google property on the web, for example, Gmail, Chrome will automatically sign the browser in to your Google account for you. And it will do this without asking or explicitly notifying you that it's done it.
So what happens to Chrome once it's logged in, which wouldn't happen if you, bearing in mind that once you're logged into a Google site, you're logged in to Google as a whole, presumably single sign-on kind of thing. So what's the difference with Chrome itself being logged in?
This is a good question. I do know that like browser history and password sharing still isn't automatically enabled when this kind of login has been invoked. You still have to sort of acknowledge that.
It is for syncing stuff like your search terms and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, for example, the developers have said this is because it was actually a bit clumsy because users were signing into Gmail and thinking they were signing into, in inverted commas, Google, but they had to separately sign the browser in as a separate operation, and it was confusing users. Apparently, this is the story we've been given, and I can believe that because I had to explain this whole thing to my wife just this week when she was asking me why is she being signed out, and I think it's because they had to show her some new terms of service as she got upgraded to Chrome 69. And she was a little confused about the whole syncing and logging into browsers. And this is like especially problematic for people who have multiple Google accounts. And, you know, as soon as you sign into your work email, for example, are you sending your browser history to your work? Are they going to be able to see that kind of stuff? Or does that information only go to Google, or does it go to your employer as well? You know, those kind of things, that decision is taken away from you because the second you log into the Gmail account or any other Google account, it synchronizes automatically. So this is a bit of a problem if you're a user of Chrome, and I believe Chromium as well.
Yeah, so I couldn't quite figure this one out. I've got Chromium 69 installed, also as a juicy snap package. And I tested this whole thing out, and I did notice, so it says here that the only warning that you'll get in the event that you've signed into a Google property is that your Google profile picture will appear in the upper right hand corner of the browser window. And sure enough, I open Chrome, I sign into Gmail, and my profile picture changes in the browser. But the UI still shows all of this stuff about sign in to Chromium. So I'm actually none the wiser whether or not I'm sort of partially signed in through the browser.
Well, exactly.
To Google, or
this is exactly how confusing it is.
Yeah. But that was using Chromium, which is, you know, an open source project, as opposed to Chrome, which is, you know, a proprietary application. So it wasn't clear to me, based on the information at hand, what exactly was being sent where.
Mm.
Yeah.
Thankfully, other privacy respecting browsers are available.
Yeah, and also I'm, you know, I might sound a bit like an ex-smoker here, but I'm rather pleased that I made the effort to switch to Firefox earlier in the year when the whole quantum thing happened, because, you know, yes, this is a concern, and if you're using Google Chrome, possibly Chromium, then this is something you should be mindful of. But the multi-profile containers that I use in Firefox give me very obvious separation between the profiles that I'm using. And although that was a departure from the way that profiles work in Google Chrome, I'm very happy that I made that switch a few months ago now. And that's the end of the news. And now it's time for some community news and event. Alan, what news did you find this week?
Major new release of Mir 1.0.0.
Oh,
yeah.
Not sound dead. The Mir is not dead, Claxon.
No, still not dead. and
very much alive, in fact.
Yes, very much a 1.0. So this was released during the sprint in Brussels, and we had a bit. I know we joke, and we've stretched this joke about Mir not being dead quite a bit. And we were sat with the Mir developers in Brussels in a bar and pointing this out to them that we were having this joke about them. And they were fine about it, but I think we probably want to dial it down a bit.
Well, it's not just they were fine about it. I think they were pleased that there was somebody fighting their corner to explain that this is still a viable technology that's, you know, backed and has a future and has a use case. Mm-hmm. And in respect of this 1.0 release, they're very excited about this being ready for internet-connected devices, for displays on IoT-style devices. And they're also really pleased to say that they've now got support for the Wayland XDG Shell extension, which is now stable.
What does that mean?
Well, this means you can start to target Wayland as a display backend without the API changing beneath you.
So, hold on. So MIR as a display server supports Wayland as a protocol?
Wayland as a display server, MIR as middleware.
Okay.
So as a developer,
yes,
you write to the simple MIR APIs and it can display on either Wayland or the MIR display server. It doesn't matter which.
Okay.
I think I need to see some examples of stuff running on this to kind of get it. I've played around with the MIR kiosk stuff to have Chromium running on Ubuntu Core device. But I understand they're working on other things that might be a bit more interesting than just having a browser running.
They are. And this doesn't feature in this 1.0 release, but they are working towards a future where you can use this to create Wayland-based desktop environments or shells. And while we were at the Sprint in Brussels, we saw a demo of a minimal Mate shell running via MIR on Wayland. So this is something that the Mate desktop team have been looking towards for a while now and is approaching viability. And I think there are some other desktop projects that are also looking to use this as a means to get Wayland compositors into their desktop environments.
Sweet.
One day I will understand this, but today is not that day.
I tell you what, maybe we should get like some of the MIR developers on to explain this in words that, you know, everyone can understand.
That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. Anyway, in other news this week, I saw that Alberto Malone has posted a call for testing of the NVIDIA drivers on Ubuntu 18.04 and 18.10. So he is the maintainer for the NVIDIA proprietary drivers in Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm.
And he's noticed a few issues with the transition in 18.04, which are related to things like using GDM in mainline Ubuntu and also some of the flavors hanging on to, what's the other one called?
LightDM?
That's the one, LightDM. So he's been working on some fixes to accommodate both. And the first fixes, he's noticed there's an increase in power consumption when the power saving profile is used, which means that the discrete GPU, NVIDIA, is turned off. And he's also noticed that there's been this inability to switch power profiles on logout, and it now requires a reboot, which is something I've noticed in Ubuntu Mate. In the little applet that we've got that provides that toggle, mm-hmm, has a prompt that says now log out and log back in, and everyone says no, that doesn't work, you have to reboot. And it did used to be a log out and a log in, and now it's a reboot.
Right.
So he's got fixes for both of these issues. That's already landed in 18.10, the daily images, and he's backported them to 18.04. We'll have a link to the show notes where he explains how you can test this on 18.04, and he's got convenient links to the bug tracker, and he would welcome you to test these things and provide your feedback so that he can be sure all of this stuff is fixed.
Awesome.
Mark, what did you find?
There is an optimized Ubuntu desktop image available in the Microsoft Hyper-V gallery.
This is the Microsoft Hyper-V gallery that nobody knew existed until Ubuntu featured in the Microsoft Hyper-V gallery, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't know about it either.
this is the sort of native Windows hypervisor,
mm-hmm,
for running VMs, and this lets you run Ubuntu VMs on Windows.
Yeah, and the Hyper-V gallery is basically a graphical application which you just choose, you know, which OS do you want to boot? And there are only two OSs in there, Windows and Ubuntu. And
some gallery.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm sure there will be more, but the nice thing is, like, first class citizen right up there with people who want to run Windows in a in a Hyper-V, there's Ubuntu in a Hyper-V. Yep. It's the only other option, which is pretty cool.
Yep. And yeah, this was another thing that got delivered in the sprint in Brussels last week. And this lands a couple of features. So it's got improved clipboard integration and dynamic desktop resizing and shared folders. So you can easily transfer folders between the host and the guest operating system. And it says here improved mouse experience, which I think means that you can now move the mouse in and out of the host and the guest desktops, right, yeah. And it all just happens without sort of jumping around randomly. What was interesting about this from my point of view is that Microsoft contributed a bunch of fixes to the open source XRDP project, and that's an open source implementation of Microsoft's own remote desktop protocol. So Microsoft were contributing the fixes there in order that Ubuntu would have a first-class experience in the Hyper-V gallery, which is, you know, credit to them. You know, yeah. New Microsoft, this is a good marker of Microsoft, you know, being good open source citizens.
So this is so that the virtualized Ubuntu is running an RDP server, is that? And then the way that it displays the desktop on Windows is via RDP.
Yeah.
Ah, nice.
And finally, in our community news roundup, Ubuntu 14.04 now receives extended security maintenance, or ESM, just like Ubuntu 12.04 did a few years ago.
Yeah, we mentioned the 12.04 one when we were surprised to learn that lots of people still want to stay on 12.04 after it went out of support. And so there's the offer of paid extended support for customers who want to stick on 12.04. And now, because of the success of that, they've extended it to 14.04 as well. So
yeah.
Customers who want to stay on 14.04 can and continue to pay for security updates.
And 14.04 looks like a much more sticky operating system than 12.04 was, even though that was, you know, particularly popular. Mm. And it's important to note that this is specifically to the server offerings. This is not for desktop. And if you want to know more about this, then we would like to refer you to the Ubuntu Security Podcast, episode 5, where Alex Murray covers this in a little bit more detail. And we have one event, Mark. What is our event?
It's the Egg and Ham Raspberry Jam. Sorry, the Egg'em Raspberry Jam. It's on the 20th of October at Gartner HQ in Staines-upon-Thames in the United Kingdom. And it's the 20th Egg'em Raspberry Jam.
Can't see Staines-upon-Thames without sniggering and thinking of Ali G.
Hi.
Yeah. This is the 20th one of those. Wow.
We've not mentioned these for a while, so yeah. Thank you, Albert, for continuing to email me about these, and I do apologise for not mentioning these more regularly. But this is for all ages, so pre-registration is free, ages 8 and over, and under 16s must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. And they have always got interesting robots and programming projects and electronics there that are suitable for all ages. So if you're in the area, it's a great event to attend.
Do you tweet? Follow at Ubuntu Podcast and like or retweet our tweets so all your Twitter buddies can find us.
And that's all for episode 29. I think this week is probably a good week to say thank you to Bitfolk, who are our VPS sponsor. If you're looking for a fine, fine VPS, then head to Bitfolk. And due to the unique way that the Ubuntu podcast is produced, we'd like to extend our thanks to Jupiter Broadcasting and Linux Academy and the services of Joe Ressington, who's producing our episodes now, and I'm picking our editorial mess. We'll see you all again soon, and next week we'll have some Linux distro, VirtualBox love, and the usual shenanigans.